Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're taking a high-speed look at Europe, specifically how the continent seems to be, well, reorganizing itself. And it looks like Germany is right at the heart of it all, newly assertive.
That's exactly the mission for today. We've got some really dense source material covering defense pacts, economic tensions, internal EU politics. We're essentially looking at three big, rapid shifts shaping this new European order.
Okay, three shifts.
Yeah. First, there's this huge, almost unexpected reset in UK-German relations. Second, the messy but kind of working reality of European defense, this patchwork idea. And finally, a major collision brewing within Brussels itself, with Germany pushing back against, you know, more EU centralization.
Right. Okay, let's dive into that first one then. The pivot that, frankly, felt like it came out of nowhere. The UK and Germany hitting the reset button with this Kensington Treaty.
It's really quite something. The Kensington Treaty, signed July 2025 Starmer and Mertz. What makes it stand out is just how broad it is. It's a full-on, legally binding friendship treaty. First of its kind, really. Covering economics, security, defense, even people-to-people stuff.
But we have to remember the context here, because just a few years back, say 2021, after the Brexit trade deal, trust was basically zero. I mean, the sources mentioned German parties worrying about the UK racing to the bottom on standards, constantly warning about the Good Friday Agreement.
Oh, absolutely. And the economic data just hammers at home. In 2016, the UK was Germany's number three trading partner. Fast forward to 2022, not even in the top 10 anymore.
Wow, that's a huge drop.
Massive economic decoupling. And politically, just as bad. Polling showed, what, less than 1% of Germans saw the UK as their most important partner? Compare that to 47% naming the US. The UK had just fallen off the map for them, priority-wise.
So what flips that script between 2022 and 2025? Why this big friendship treaty now? Was it just the new UK government?
Yeah.
Well, that certainly helps smooth things over. Starmer and Scholz initially built some goodwill. But the real driver, according to the sources, was the security situation in Europe getting much, much dicier.
Ukraine.
Obviously. Ukraine, yes. Plus rising fears about Russia, maybe a less reliable U.S. down the line. Suddenly, cooperating closely on security with the UK, which, let's face it, has Europe's most capable military, became essential for Germany, regardless of who was in power. That urgency meant talks kept going smoothly, even when Mertz and the CDU took over from Scholz.
And the actual content of the treaty, it sounds quite significant, a bilateral mutual defense clause tied to NATO. That really changes the game, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. Security is the bedrock here. Beyond that mutual defense bit, they're talking joint precision strike projects. That points to some serious military integration. But it's not just security.
Right. You said it was broader.
Much broader. Diplomacy, development aid, internal security, justice, migration, economic resilience, climate change. It's designed to lock in the relationship long term. A complete reset.
And they included some tangible things, too, right? To show it wasn't just high-level politics.
Exactly. Those 17 priority projects.
Yeah.
Things like visa-free school trips, direct trains between the countries. Practical stuff to make it feel real for people.
Hmm.
But, and this is a crucial point the sources make.
There's always a but.
There's always a nuance check. The success of this shiny new bilateral deal is still really tangled up with how the wider UK-EU relationship evolves.
Why is that? If London and Berlin agree on something, why does Brussels still matter so much?
It comes down to who has the power, the legal competence, for different issues. A lot of the shared priorities, coordinating aid for Ukraine, handling migration, sorting out customs, these are areas where the EU sets the rules or the framework.
Oh, okay.
So the real power of the Kensington Treaty might not just be the UK and Germany acting alone, but Germany using its clout inside the EU to make UK-EU cooperation smoother in those areas they both care about.
That tension bilateral deals versus the big EU machine leads us nicely into the whole European defense puzzle. We're seeing Russian provocations, drones over Poland, MiGs near Estonia. There's a clear sense that Europe needs to step up for its own security, but getting 27 countries to agree on anything quickly is, well,
a nightmare, basically. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's exactly why this idea of patchwork Europe is gaining traction, because getting consensus among all 27 EU members is so painfully slow. Real, practical defense work is shifting to smaller, more flexible groups, coalitions that form and maybe reform based on the need. It looks messy, maybe, but it's practical. It actually gets things done.
And the sources list a whole bunch of these specific groups, this sort of alphabet soup of defense initiatives. Can you walk us through the main ones? What are they each trying to achieve?
Okay, yeah, let's break them down. There are about five key ones highlighted. First, you've got Operation Eastern Sentry. This is very specific, a NATO thing, but driven by just five countries, France, Germany, UK, Italy, Denmark, reacting to those recent border incidents. The U.S. is deliberately keeping a low profile. It's all about showing immediate deterrence.
Okay, immediate response. What else?
Second, the drone wall. Think of this as an infrastructure project. 10 EU countries plus Ukraine are involved, building this layered defense system along the border with Russia using sensors, counter drones, that kind of thing. Very geographically and technologically focused.
Makes sense. Number three.
Third is the European Sky Shield Initiative, or ESI. Germany's been leading this since 2022. 15 countries are in, even non-NATO ones like Switzerland. This is purely about plugging the massive gaps in air defense across Central Europe, mostly through joint procurement of systems, territorial defense.
Right, filling those critical gaps. And the UK leads one, too.
Yes. Fourth is the Joint Expeditionary Force, or JEF, UK-led, includes Scandinavian and Baltic nations. Their focus is different again. Rapid reaction, deployability. They talk about multi-domain operations, land, sea, air, cyber. Think quick response force.
Got it. And finally, the EU's own structure.
And last, you have PESCO. That's the EU's formal framework for defense cooperation. It's got over 40 different subgroups working on things like cyber warfare, artillery systems, etc. But the common criticism of PESCO is that it's often too slow, too bureaucratic, focused on long-term development rather than fixing immediate problems, which, you know, is why these other faster coalitions have popped up.
So the patchwork actually makes sense because each piece does something different. JEF for speed, ESSI for air defense, the drone wall for a specific border, they fill niches PESCO struggles with.
Precisely. Mm-hmm. And that Kensington Treaty we talked about, it slots right into this patchwork reality.
Mm-hmm.
It strengthens that key E3 strategic triangle, Germany, Britain, France, which are already linked by other agreements. But, and this is key, for the E3 to really work effectively together, Paris and Berlin need to be willing to coordinate outside the formal EU structure sometimes, even if it annoys other EU members.
Which brings us perfectly to pivot number three, that internal EU power struggle. It really centers on the new German Chancellor, Friedrich Merz, making some big moves. He seems to be trying to pull power back to Berlin, focus on national economics, and basically put the brakes on any more EU federalism. And that puts him squarely against the Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen.
Yeah, it's fascinating to watch. Merz isn't being subtle about prioritizing German interests right now, or his preference for quick bilateral deals over getting bogged down in complex EU processes. And his disagreements with von der Leyen have been very public, very sharp, right from the start of his term.
Let's dig through those clashes. First up, the big one, the EU budget.
Huge clash. Von der Leyen floated this idea in July for the next long-term EU budget, expanding it to a massive $2 trillion. That's a giant leap towards a more federal EU. Merz shot it down immediately and very publicly. He said, and I'm quoting roughly, "For Germany, I can rule out that we will go down such a path. Just a flat no, a veto on her federal ambitions."
Wow. Okay. And then there was trade, particularly with the U.S.
He was very critical of how long the EU-U.S. trade talks were taking, basically saying Brussels wasn't moving fast enough to get a good deal. And then when von der Leyen did reach an agreement with the Trump administration, one that still included a 15% tariff on many EU goods, Merz was openly unhappy. He claimed it would cause significant damage to the German economy, essentially blaming the Commission for not protecting German industry well enough. His whole approach seems to be quick and bilateral is better than slow and EU-wide.
And that very public correction about potential troops in Ukraine, that seemed to question the Commission's role fundamentally.
Absolutely. Von der Leyen mentioned having precise plans for EU troops as a potential post-war security force in Ukraine. Merz immediately corrected the record, stating flatly, no such plan existed, at least not in Germany. He stressed that kind of military deployment is purely a job for national governments and NATO, not the EU. And he's also been adamant that national capitals, not Brussels, get the final say on buying weapons, pushing back against von der Leyen's push for more centralized defense procurement.
You can see the domestic pressure on Merz, right? He needs to jumpstart the German economy after its contraction. Plus, he's got the AfD nipping at his heels, even leading in some polls. But hang on, isn't there a weird paradox here for France? If Merz blocks that huge EU budget and slows down centralization, doesn't that actually help Macron's vision of strategic autonomy by keeping Brussels weaker, even if Merz's defense spending choices make Paris nervous?
That is the absolute core paradox. You're right, Merz pushing back against EU federalism does align with Macron's long-held desire to keep power in national capitals. But at the same time, the sheer scale and direction of Merz's defense spending plans are causing huge anxiety in Paris. Macron is reportedly obsessed, is the word used, with Germany's financial firepower for rearmament. The fear is Germany will just use its checkbook diplomacy and sideline the European defense industry Macron wants to build.
And the numbers really tell that story, don't they? The budget gap.
They really do. Right now, German defense spending, $86 billion, isn't wildly different from France's, $62 billion. But look ahead to 2029. Germany's planning to spend $150 billion. France's best projection is maybe $80 billion. That's a $70 billion difference every year. It's enormous.
Just staggering. And how Germany plans to spend that extra money is the real sticking point for France.
That's the fear. Paris worries that Germany, in its rush to rearm, will just buy readily available American military kit instead of investing in joint European projects. The sources specifically mention French dismay over a deal between Rheinmetall, the German defense giant, and Anduril, a U.S. tech company, for drones and missiles. Paris sees Berlin choosing American tech for speed rather than building up Europe's own military-industrial base.
So Merz fights von der Leyen, slowing EU political integration, which Macron might secretly like, then he potentially undermines Macron's military strategic autonomy goals by buying American.
Exactly. It's a real bind for France. They seem to acknowledge that the future of European strategic autonomy is now, to a large extent, in Germany's hands. It all depends on whether Berlin chooses to coordinate closely with Paris on defense industrial matters or keeps looking outside, mainly to the U.S., for quick security fixes.
Okay, let's shift to another crucial relationship, but one plagued by historical baggage rather than just current politics. Germany and Poland. Economically huge, $170 billion in trade, but politically so fragile.
It's deeply troubled, yes. The toxicity of history looms large. The most prominent issue is Poland's reiterated demand, voiced by President Karol Naroki, for $1.3 trillion in World War II reparations from Germany for Nazi atrocities. That figure is just immense, more than Poland's entire annual GDP.
How does a number like that even stay on the table? Is it a genuine policy goal or more about domestic politics in Poland?
Well, it's kind of both. The Polish government insists it's based on a detailed, official calculation of wartime losses, so they frame it as a legitimate historical claim. But politically, everyone knows $1.3 trillion is impossible. Germany apparently offered something like $200 million as a gesture, which was rejected. But then, intriguingly, a Polish policymaker hinted that maybe $200 million per year for 5 years could be a starting point for talks. So maybe a structured reconciliation fund rather than full reparations. A tiny bit of wiggle room, perhaps.
But it's not just the reparations demand souring things now, is it? There are other recent irritants.
No, there are several current flashpoints. Recently, the Polish government fired its main coordinator for German relations, apparently because he was willing to discuss the sensitive issue of German cultural artifacts currently held in Poland. Then Germany brought in border checks on the Polish border without really warning Warsaw first. And Poland keeps complaining that Germany isn't doing enough to help them manage illegal migration coming across the border from Belarus.
It sounds like a minefield. But given how important the economic ties are, what are people suggesting could actually help stabilize things? Any practical steps?
The focus seems to be on practical diplomacy and symbolic gestures. First, Germany really needs to build that memorial to Polish victims of the war that the Bundestag approved back in 2020. Second, Germany's culture minister could launch a big campaign to showcase Polish culture in Germany, build some goodwill. Third, German companies are being encouraged to invest more in the poorer, rural eastern parts of Poland, where anti-German feeling can be stronger. And finally, a defense gesture. Berlin could offer Poland, say, 4 submarines on very favorable terms, like the deals they have with Israel, as a sign of a special security partnership.
Wow. We've covered a lot of ground here. A huge bilateral reset between the UK and Germany, this messy but functioning defense patchwork, the power struggle inside the EU between Merz and von der Leyen, and this incredibly deep, difficult historical friction with Poland. Germany seems to be right at the center of all of it.
That's the clear picture emerging. This new German assertiveness, driven by massive defense spending and internal politics, is really shaking up Europe's power dynamics. On one hand, it's building strong bilateral links, like the new one with the UK. On the other, it's actively challenging Brussels' central authority in that tussle with von der Leyen.
And for you listening, perhaps the clearest takeaway is what's happening on the ground, operationally. When you look at European defense now, JF, SE, PESCO, the drone wall, what you actually see are these specialized, smaller groups moving fast, finding practical ways around the difficulty of getting everyone to agree.
Which leads to that final provocative thought. Given how hard it clearly is to get all 27 EU members on the same page quickly, especially in a crisis, are these flexible, shifting, maybe sometimes messy patchwork coalitions actually where Europe's real effective strength will always lie? Are they politically sustainable in the long run, or just crisis responses? Perhaps Europe's future defense reality is destined to be defined by these agile small groups, regardless of grand visions or new treaties coming out of Brussels.